John has agreed to take questions, and he'll be the designator of the questioner.
That's the way. Don't call on you. Back there. And all the hard questions go to Father.
Richard Miller, Creighton, Zelda Department. I just want to know, what would you say are the differences between the present document and the previous document? What would you say?
Title, political responsibility versus faithful citizenship, process, in that it used to be a fairly mechanical process, just summarizing what was. It is now much more a teaching document, which tries to articulate what the church has said and will say. The issues have shifted but not changed. There's more emphasis on war and peace. There's more emphasis on immigration. There is certainly more emphasis on care for creation. I think a consistent theme throughout has been a commitment to human life. The first document came out 4 years after Roe v. Wade. It was actually 73, so 3 years after Roe v. Wade. I think a million abortions a year, 30 million abortions, hangs over this document and everything else in this country. I think that commitment to human life has been expressed in different ways through the years. In some ways it has become more urgent. I think in some ways it expresses frustration. My bet is that the bishops and a lot of us never thought that 35 years later we would be struggling to ban partial birth abortion. So those would be some of the things. I think the biggest change, and I don't want to be quoted on this, the journalists in the room. I think when Benedict said the role of the church is to form consciences in public life, it was like bingo. I mean, that's a good Catholic word. It was like they named what they thought they were doing. They don't want to be political leaders, yet they don't want to stand aside as war continues, as abortion haunts the nation, as gaps between rich and poor. But they don't see themselves as political leaders. They see themselves as pastors and teachers and leaders. So when the Pope said, our role is to form consciences so that people may understand their responsibility more seriously, more clearly, so that they will act more decisively. I was with them as they wrote this, and they said, that's who we are. That's what we're about. So I think that we should have figured that out a long time ago. There's a lot of talk about conscience throughout, but that really pinned it. I think the notion of political homelessness, whether you agree with it or feel it, has developed over time. I think there is a frustration about not finding a natural political home and having few good choices. My hope, frankly, and this is me, not them, I hope the attention will move from declaring ourselves homeless to building a home, to building a shelter at least, to finding a place in both parties or in other structures to stand up for consistently for human life and dignity. I think that's one of the big challenges ahead of us. So process, title. One other thing that I think has been interesting, probably in the mid-90s, in addition to the bishop's reflection and the listing of issues, two other things were added in a formal sense. One was a list of questions for the campaign, or in this case, challenges for the campaign, which if you have the document, lists sort of 10 things, and they are not the typical campaign questions. And the other thing that developed is instead of the summary, the short version, the bulletin version of the document, just being a staff function, little brochure that we put together, the bishops have figured out that this is what most people read, so they themselves spend a lot of time figuring out what it says and what you have to leave out. So those would be some of the shifts. Over here.
Please follow our first questioner's example by identifying yourself as he asks the question.
So, my name is Philip Wilkerchuk. I am a sophomore undergraduate student at Creighton University. And, the United States is a secular liberal democracy. Most countries of the West, all countries of the West are, and this seems to be the current guiding paradigm and political systems, and that's unlikely to change. So, as a Catholic, do you believe that for the Church to be more effective in expressing its message to people who don't necessarily identify themselves with the Catholic faith or with any faith at all, to argue not maybe so much from papal encyclicals and biblical passages as for example, sociological data? Like when we take the issue of example, would you say that maybe just to have a wider reach and a more pervasive sort of response, would it be better for bishops to, as opposed to, for example, quoting Evangelium Vitae or biblical passages, for example, give scientific facts well after so many weeks, the first brain waves are, et cetera?
I think there are two kinds of conversations, and there's a lot of them in between. This is one that Father Hollenbeck is especially knowledgeable about. When we talk in our own community, we rightly look to the sources of wisdom. We would say the sources of truth, and that would be the life and words of Jesus, the scriptures, and the teaching of the Church. They give us a way of looking at the world. For example, when it comes to economic life, we look at it from the bottom up. Left to my own devices, I would not look at it from the bottom up. But when we move into the public square, we make our case using the ways you describe, scientific fact, rational argument. One of the great lines from the encyclical is reasoning. We want to contribute to better reasoning about these issues. We believe that what has been revealed to us is not only ours, but belongs to everybody, and that can be discovered by everybody, even if they don't share our religious convictions. So, for example, when we argue on climate change, I testified before the Senate on climate change. I said the real inconvenient truth, with all due respect to the former vice president, was that those who contribute least to the problem, the poor, in our own country and around the world, were going to be affected the most, and they had the least capacity to avoid the consequences of that, and they had the least resources to cope. Now, that's a biblical principle. You'll be judged by response to the least of these. It is a Catholic teaching principle, the option for the poor. But it is also a simple question of justice, which those who have done the least to create the problem and have least capacity to cope with the problem ought to be protected. So as you suggest, I think we try and find a way to make our case based on what we believe to a community that in some cases shares our values and others didn't. One of the things Pope Benedict said in his talk at the White House was that the American version of secularism is different in that it provided a greater space for religious people and religious thought. And he said it'll be interesting, the Church thinks in centuries, it'll be interesting to see whether this works out. We think, you know, we've been at it 200 years, we'd have an answer to that question. He says it'll be interesting to see how this goes. So, I tried to make the case, others here are better equipped to it, that our Constitution, our framework as a nation, allows us to make our case based on everything we are, believers and citizens. And so we come into the public square in both ways. We are believers formed in our faith. We are citizens trying to persuade a majority of our fellow citizens to join us on a whole host of issues. David, do you want to comment here? You've only written about three books on this.
Well, it's just I think that the Catholic tradition would want to argue that these two realities of respective faith grounded and biblically grounded and one that's reason grounded are complementary and not in any way contradictory. So it's another one of those ads up there rather than one or the other. It's both.
For me, as a committed pro-lifer. Doctrine is not helping me make my case. I've sort of done that for a while. Anyone who's seen a sonogram knows that we're not talking about a clump of cells. You know, science is on our side here. When we're rescuing kids in the womb from some illness or some deformity, when we do surgery, we did a wonderful day, Dan was a part of it, where we focused on environmental threats to unborn children, mercury and lead and air pollution. And so we had our pro-life friends and we had our environmental friends. And by the end of the day, the environmentalists were not talking about the fetus. They were talking about the unborn child. It is very hard to say that we ought to prevent the fetus from being exposed to lead, but then we ought to be able to destroy that fetus. It was an interesting thing. One, we ought to protect those kids in the womb from lead and mercury because it really diminishes them in their lives. On the other hand, it's also a way to engage and persuade people that what we're talking about is something worth saving. So, other comments or questions over here.
From your experience, the effect of this 30 years of reflection on faithful citizenship, then one of where Catholics have become more involved in the political process. I guess my fear is that this seems like a good awakening to testifying, voting, thinking about issues, but not necessarily being a political Catholic leader. I mean, are there any faithful citizen Catholic leaders?
It's not easy, frankly. We had a meeting with Catholic legislators on the war. And it, in typical fashion, started with a group of Catholic Democrats who, frankly, had their problems with the church on the abortion issue. And they said, let's have a meeting about the war. And their plan was we'd have a meeting, we'd have a press conference, and they'd say, you know, see, I'm with the church on something really important. And the response of our bishops was, we'd be happy to meet, but there are two conditions. One, we want to meet on a bipartisan basis. We want to meet with Republicans and Democrats who are Catholic. And we want to have a private conversation about what the obligations of faith might be on this, not a public one. So there's not going to be a press conference. And the staff of those members said, oh, we don't do it that way. We don't do bipartisan and we always do press conferences. And the bishop said, well, good, we don't meet. Well, they came back and they said, okay, let's meet. So we had one morning for 2.5 hours, which doesn't sound like much, but is a lifetime on Capitol Hill. We had 30 members of Congress, Democrat or Republican, wrestling with what was the right thing to do based on their faith. Some of whom had voted for the war, some of whom opposed the war. A lot of focus on refugees, a lot of focus on how do you change the policy when there's polarization. It was a private meeting, but one congressman, a Republican, said, a convert, he said he had joined the church for two reasons, the Eucharist and Catholic social teaching, and he said he had cast a sincere vote for the war. He really believed the president. And he said it was the worst vote he had ever cast, and that even though he thought the president was sincere and he was sincere, and he regretted it every day, he said, I just cannot believe that I did not listen to John Paul, and I did not take seriously enough the questions of the bishops. He said, every day I try and think of what I can do to make up for that. He says, I write a letter to every family of every soldier that's killed. And he said, I'm probably going to lose. I'm from a district where my opposition to the war is a very heavy political burden. He says, but you know what I figure? I figure it's more important to get to heaven than to get reelected. That stunned that group. This is not a conversation that's normally had in these hearing rooms. And out of that has come a quiet effort, not successful thus far, to build up enough common ground in the middle, not to cut off money for the war because there are not enough votes, not to stay the course because there are not enough votes, but to begin to fashion a different policy with a different set of benchmarks. So It is very difficult. And congresspeople on both sides would tell you, to be a pro-life Democrat is very hard work these days. To be a, I don't want to say pro-poor, because there is differences about how you stand with the poor. But, for example, I thought the S-CHIP vote was a pretty clear-cut vote to get health care for kids. To stand against the House leadership in the White House to vote on a very partisan basis for S-CHIP, very hard work. My own view is that two things ought to happen, at least. One, more of us ought to get involved. So there ought to be more people in both parties who share a consistent concern for human life and dignity. And two, our job at the national level and your job at the local level is to both support and challenge people, to encourage them to do the hard thing, to do the right thing, and to know there's a cost when they cave in to pressure for partisan purposes or from their contributors or whatever. My own view is that this is the work of a lifetime, not one election. I don't think we're going to prevail on central questions of human life through a purely political strategy. I think we got to change the way people think about human life. They got to change their head and their hearts. As long as people think of an unborn child as a burden or an imposition, as long as they think of the elderly as a burden, as long as they think of criminals as animals unworthy of being treated with dignity, as long as they think torture is just something we have to do to protect ourselves, as long as they think that civilians, mothers and fathers and children killed in Iraq are just collateral damage. We even talk about them as if they... We have to rethink the way we think about human life and dignity, and then we may be able to make progress on abortion, on war, on the death penalty, even though they're different issues. Back there. Can you speak up just a little? I'm a hearing problem.
I'm intrigued by a statement in the document, and I wanted to get your feedback on it.
Sure.
It says here, yet the candidate's position on a single issue that involves an intrinsic evil, such as support for illegal abortion or the promotion of racism, may legitimately lead to a vote of disqualified candidate from receiving support. That's my the question is that racism the first time? This document was another document. And did the U.S. bishops know that Obama was going to be a frontrunner here? I mean, we're talking about a big issue of race.
Yeah. Did we know that Obama
won? It's going to be a frontrunner, an issue of race.
Well, I think the only person who was sure about that was Obama. I'll tell you where that came from. This was a matter of considerable debate. There's another whole section of the document where it talks about how you can never support something which is intrinsically evil, and the example is abortion and racism. We had a number of bishops, and in this case both white and African-American bishops from the South, and they said, we're talking about racism as an intrinsic evil that is alive in our community, so we can have people who are right on a number of issues, and you really know that racism is a part of who they are, and you have to be able to say that's disqualifying for us. The example they used, it wasn't a very good example, but it was a very vivid one, was when David Duke won a nomination for the governor of Louisiana, and he was running against Edwin Edwards, who was, everybody believed, was a very effective governor and a crook. And he eventually served time, you know. Edwin Edwards had the great line. He said, the only way I can be defeated is that I'm caught with a live boy or a dead woman in bed. You know, this is a very vivid politician. So the bumper sticker, I still have it, was, vote for the crook, it's really important. So that was not about Obama. That was about the experience of these bishops and our church in dealing with racism. I'll suggest that I am one who does not believe it's a good idea to suggest that all anti-immigrant sentiment is racist, or that disagreement about the best immigration policy is a matter of prejudice. But clearly there are elements of it. You know, I don't know anybody who wants to build a wall to keep the Canadians out, you know. I think it is the open wound in our society. And so for the bishops, this was not a political judgment. This was a moral judgment.
I think we're on a roll here that could exhaust us. So I'm going to call us, if you are caught up in the energy of this discussion tonight, that you come back tomorrow and join us. And also, we have a reception for as long as we can be in this building, upstairs in Snyder Commons. So at this point, would you join me in thanking John?